Okay, so let's get started after something of a hiatus. So we have been discussing, if you recall, when we last left our hero, we were discussing preparations for Erev Shabbos and Shmirah Shabbos Kel Chazav. This brought us to Perek Mem Beis, which is really the second chelek of Shmirah Shabbos Kel Chazav. This is the second chelek Beis here. For anybody who has the original two-volume set at home, I'm not sure what it precisely correlates to in the English rendition, but I believe they translated the second volume as well. So at any rate, we are down here, I think is where we left off, at this subsection of Hakpada al Kashrus Hamazon Lesu'udos Shabbos V'yomto, which is a really, really interesting topic. The notion of trying to be particularly careful, especially careful when it comes to the kashrus of the food for the Su'udos of Shabbos and Yomtov that we might be preparing. Now, of course, it hopefully goes without saying that kashrus is something that is not only limited to Shabbos and Yomtov preparation, but it rises to a particular pitch when it comes to Erev Shabbos and Erev Yom Tov, both because of what the Shmir Shabbos Kilkasa is going to say in his introduction, that it is important that we not lose sight of things, and in the hustle of Erev Shabbos and in the sometimes the stress of Erev Shabbos and the stress of Erev Yom Tov, that we not lose sight of that which halacha demands. So let's begin there. A person needs to be careful regarding the various principles of kashrus. If he doesn't do so, which is a very, very important reality to keep in mind, that whatever it is that you gain, whatever it is that you gain because you are busy preparing for Shabbos and because you're going to have a beautiful Shabbos, you'll have a yontif table that's adorned with all of the foods that have been prepared. Remember, whatever it is that you gain, you more than lose by making food that isn't absolutely properly kosher according to the standards that we generally hold ourselves by. The Navi Kan Kama Min Advarim HaShechichim B'Yoser. So he says that what we're going to speak of are those things that are most common. And that really introduces point number two, right? If point number one is don't lose sight of things, and they can especially happen as, again, we get stressed and we get very, very, it's always something of a pressure cooker come Erev Shabbos, probably especially Erev Yom Tov. And when it comes to the importance of preparing properly for those holy, holy days, sometimes we can lose sight of baseline halacha, like, you know, whatever it is that we might have to sacrifice because of stress. And that's often when some of those nisyonos take place, when some of those challenges and some of those inner sorts of tests regarding our care and our concern with halacha. Yeah, but when we're really stressed out and we really need to accomplish some things, then sometimes we can start bending the rules. So let's bear in mind, right? The reason why we're stressed because of Shabbos, because we're trying to prepare for Shabbos, because we're trying to do what's right, halachically speaking. So if things aren't precisely so, sometimes it's just a matter of like counting to 10 and taking a step back and realizing, you know, like it'll be okay. We'll be able to regroup. If I don't have the opportunity to get, those couple of dishes in the oven, so then we'll be able to still regroup. We'll have other food. Nobody will go hungry. It'll be okay. This can happen on Shabbos as well. It's just an important mentality to develop when we become stressed out and we feel that we are about to do something that we shouldn't do, to at least like count to 10 and remember, you know what? Okay, so if we don't have hot water, it'll be okay. So if the crock pot didn't go on, and if we don't have the crock, we don't have the jalan, we don't have whatever it was that we put up, well, we'll make amends, we'll make do, we'll find a way. We'll find a way of still being able to have a nice Shabbos, and everything will be okay. But not to potentially fall into this place of Yatzah Schar B'Hafseido. So that's number one. Number two is, as he's going to discuss, is that Erev Shabbos, Erev Yontif, especially Erev Yontif, I think, when we're preparing multiple meals, and if we're talking about something like maybe a three-day Yontif, where one or two of those meals may invariably end up being, let's say, a milchik meal or milchik meals, so then there may just be a lot going on in our kitchen, and some of the basar b'chal of realities maybe come to a head, especially at those times, more so than they do during other times when we have more time, when we're only worrying about, you know, what is the average output of any given kitchen on any given weekday? Not that much. You know, breakfast, I don't know, you hobble something together, take a few things from the pantry, some cereal, some milk, and lunch, I don't know, you make a sandwich, you make a salad or whatever. And when it comes to really cooking, you're usually thinking about maybe like one meal, you know, maybe one meal a day, and under most conditions. And therefore, the amount that could go wrong, the number of different types of items and dishes that are being prepared and potentially even stuffed into either the same oven or being utilized on the same appliances as one another. So that's not really nearly as much of a concern during the week as it may become on Erev Shabbos. And that, I think, really is what he's pointing out here more than anything. So let's take a look at this first. Yeah, at this first item. Ein la'efos b'tanur afiyash etzolim bo basar. So we don't bake or cook milchig dishes in a fleishig oven. So let's define, let's be clear, he's defining fleishig oven. Not to cook or to roast b'tanur afiyashet solimbo basar, that you roast meat in, not to then use that for dairy dishes as well. V'af lo divrei ma'afas stamim, and not even to make stam foods, parva foods, if the intention is that those foods are then going to be eaten with milk. It's not only that's usher to do so at the same time. Doesn't mean that it's only problematic if you have dairy foods and meat foods in the oven at the same time. Doesn't mean only if you have meat foods and para foods that you intend to eat with a milchig meal in the oven at the same time. You're making some kind of kugel that you intend to be parav. And because it's parav, it gives you flexible options. You could have it with a fleishig suda, you could have it with a milchig suda, but it's being cooked. It's being cooked in the oven at the same time as the fleishigs, then you can no longer serve it with the milchig food. Ki'im, not only that, if it's cooking at the same time, but ki'im af bazeh achar zeh yeshal hachmir. Not only that, but even if it's zeh achar zeh, even if it's one after the other, even if you remove the meat from the oven to then cook something else inside, that would still be problematic if that something else is either milchigs, or again, if it's parav and the intention is to serve it with a milchig meal. V'im hu michaseh echad mishnei haminim b'michseh o b'niyar aluminium, or if you were to then cover as a way out, if you were to cover one of the dishes, if you were, let's say, to cover it's the fleishig oven, but you're covering the dairy either with a real lid or you're covering it even with, let's say, aluminum foil. So then harizeh mutter b'chol ofen. Because what happens is that steam, whatever steam is going to be emitted from let's say, the milchig dish, is going to be trapped. It's going to be trapped underneath that aluminum foil. It's going to be trapped underneath that pot lid or that pan lid. And therefore, if no steam is escaping, you now have no more medium that can serve as an exchange between whatever has been absorbed, whatever fleishigs has reached, let's say, the top of the oven, and the milchigs that's contained therein, or with the fleishigs that is right now presently actively being cooked inside of the oven, and the milchigs that's being cooked therein. Note that what Shmir Shabbos Kolchos is saying is that when do we run into a problem? When it's cooked bazeh achar zeh. Bazeh achar zeh, one is roasted after the other. First you cook fleishigs, then immediately afterwards you cook milchigs. So what about cooking one after the other? Different people have different minhagim, and poskim actually hold differently when it comes to how to utilize, let's say, one oven for different foods, meaning for both fleishigs and also milchigs. There are those who hold that as long as the oven has cooled down in between, it's no longer considered to be zeh achar zeh, that whatever has now at that point been absorbed up into the actual walls of the oven, now that it's cooled down in between, even if the dairy food then does emit some steam, that's not going to serve as a channel to be able to carry the fleishigs back out of the oven. Some hold that it needs to be a full 24 hours in between. Others hold that you can't do this. You can't do it at all. That you cannot have something milchig in an oven that has at some point been used for fleishig, if that milchig item is going to emit any steam whatsoever, because the steam absolutely can draw. It can be polate, or it can be maflit. It can draw. It can expel some of the fleishig steam that was absorbed into the walls of the oven, into the ceiling of the oven. It can now be expelled. It can now be drawn out by the steam that emerges and that's emitted from, let's say, this new milchig food that you're putting inside. And therefore, the only way to put milchig food inside of an oven that's been used for fleishigs would be if it's completely covered, or obviously if you kasher in between, if you kasher the oven from one to the other. There's a lot to be said for going that approach simply because of the simplicity, simply because of the not needing to then make a cheshbon one way or the other as to what the oven perhaps was previously used for. If it's a self-cleaning oven, self-clean in between, correct, right? Meaning koshering, right? A koshering in between, self-cleaning for the most part, potentially maybe needing to take care of the door a little bit, but for the most part, self-cleaning in between would render it koshered. If you don't have a self-cleaning oven, so then koshering as you ordinarily would for Pesach with the easy off and all that, that becomes much more onerous. But there's a lot to be said. There's a lot to be said for having just two completely separate dedicated ovens. We use our oven exclusively for Fleishig, and then we have a separate, it's really a toaster oven, but it's a large toaster oven. It could accommodate a full 9x13 tin, which means that we can still do lasagna and eggplant parmesan and whatever. So there was a lot of merit in doing that. There was a lot of merit in doing so. At any rate, so why are we talking about kashrus? Why are we talking about kashrus right now? Because this is when these things can happen, right? It's not so typical that you would need to cook both fleishigs and milchigs at the same time, unless you're thinking about preparing, let's say, multiple meals in advance, which could very well happen when it comes to either Shabbos or Yontif. I'm cooking milchigs for, let's say, right now, and I know that I'm also going to need a fleishig meal for later, for Yontif or for Shabbos, and even a couple of days from now. Thursday night dinner, and I'm also simultaneously cooking for Shabbos. Right? That's when these things typically happen. I don't know how it could be that everyone here is better planned than we are, but it's not usually the case, at least in our house, that Tuesday night dinner, we're also thinking about Wednesday night and also thinking about Thursday night. That doesn't usually go down. It's usually because of thinking about Shabbos, thinking about Yom Tov. That's when these things come to a head, and that's when it's really worthwhile to keep some of these principles in mind.
Rabbi?
Yeah.
Can you clarify the point about covering one of the dishes? When is that effective? Is that when they're both in the oven?
If they're both in the oven at the same time, but the milchig, let's say you're talking about an otherwise fleishig oven, right? And the fleishig food is in the oven at the same time, even, but the milchig food is completely covered, right? That's what he's talking about. The milchig food is completely covered, completely surrounded. Then it's effective. It's effective because there's no steam that's being emitted from the milchigs, and therefore, as a general rule, steam zeya is treated more leniently than, let's say, an actual water bath or an actual full liquid medium, right? Where you have, let's say, boiling water or that kind of thing. Steam is not considered to be of the same potency. So if you have, and especially in an oven where they're also not directly touching one another, right? So if the milk food is completely covered, that could be placed inside. It's basically in its own oven, right? It's basically completely concealed. It's cordoned off from everything else that's going on in the oven, even if what's going on in the oven is legitimate fleishigs.
Is that true if it's just one covering, like a piece of aluminum foil over it, or is this...
Yeah, double covering is, you know, it's a good idea. I think I just lost video. Hold on a second. It's worthwhile, particularly double coverings are utilized when we're talking about something that's really treif. So if let's say you're using an oven that is suspect with respect to, you know, its kashrus status to begin with. Right, we don't know what was inside. Well, we don't know what was inside at all. So that's when a double covering becomes more critical. How about maras ayin? In what capacity, Maria?
Seeing the oven baking fleishigs and milchigs at the same time, even though one of them is covered.
Right.
It's just weird.
Yeah, Maris Ayin is a tricky one, meaning that we don't usually invent our own brand of Maris Ayin or our own examples of Maris Ayin, right? As a general rule, what you're doing is that you're cooking two things in the oven at the same time. Cooking two things in the oven at the same time isn't usher, right? It's usher to have the actual basar b'chalav that are really cooked together, That's usher. But, you know, to some degree, in the dover sof. What happens if I have a pot on the stove? Yesterday, I was cooking milchigs on the stove. Today, I'm cooking fleishigs on the stove. Is that also ma'arasayim? Because maybe to the untrained eye, nobody else knows that, you know, this pot is really actually a different one than the one that I had for fleishigs. I know that they're different. I know that one was fleishigs and one was milchigs. But maybe to somebody else, it looks like, I don't know, that same pot in the same spot. Now it's being used for fleishigs. Yesterday it was used for milchigs or vice versa. So the concern, the problem with ma'arasayim, with sort of creating our own ma'arasayim concerns, is that it's very difficult to know at what point we can put a stop to it. As a general rule, we follow halakha, and when we're doing something that's mutter, then somebody else might also think that it's usher, but it's not usher. So we certainly don't want to give people the wrong impression. But as a general rule, for following halakhic principles, we don't also worry about ma'arasayim except for where Chazal, you know, instituted or made us aware of that specific concern, or made an institution because of that concern, because something was prevalent and because there was, you know, a lot of great deal of confusion surrounding something. But generally, if we're following principles of kashrus, let's see, in our own lives and in our own kitchens, then that's sufficient, right? Cooking fleishig with milchig, that's problematic. Cooking fleishig and milchig separately from one another is not problematic. This is separate. Yeah.
Rabbi, how about in the food industry, like in, you know, like in a kashrus, in a place where you go purchasing food? I mean, is it acceptable for a place to be cooking both at the same time,
generally not? And the reason is that, as a general rule, it's a very, very good point. As a general rule, when it comes to things that are done in more of the commercial setting, the lines are drawn in a much more stark capacity, because there is always going to be more, processing than there are eyes to watch it. So to some degree, when it comes to actual kashrus and presenting and providing kashrus supervision, we need actual policies in place that are going to make it very, very difficult to actually concoct and to create something that's non-kosher, which means that as just a matter of policy, right, industry standard, the way that kashrus organizations will often do business is that they will err on the side of caution and even not allowing the kinds of things that can even come close to presenting a kashrus issue, because there isn't necessarily going to be there to catch it. Right, but that's a very different reality than, let's say, somebody who is from running their own home and knowing the difference between what's kosher and what's not kosher, knowing the difference between what's acceptable and not acceptable. So there are certain things that need to be perforce put in place, because if not, you're just inviting trouble and you're inviting problems in, let's say, a commercial or industrial setting. But that isn't necessarily the case when it comes to a private or a residential setting. There are many, many, many gezeros, takanos, siyugim, precautionary measures that were instituted even when it comes to our own kitchens. The idea of having two separate sets of dishes largely is just a precaution. It's a precautionary measure. Right? Rather than assume, well, it's an eno ben yomo, and it has to be used in a day, and there really is no tam, and by this point it's a tam pogum. And in many instances, it's batal anyway. We don't do that. We have two completely different sets of dishes. And even if it did absorb some dish, so what? So if it absorbed, it wasn't cooked together with it. That wasn't an act of bishul. There was no actual bishul that took place between the basar and the chalav, which would really be mutter, midor raisa, midor rabbanan, it's asar. So there are many, many like rungs and orbits, right, that extend out from the actual isra dal raisa, even in the residential setting. But knowing the, you know, ma'arasayim becomes a difficult game to play, because again, in ledover sof, like where does it end? Where does it end? So we usually follow Chazal's lead on that, you know, rather than presuming that something really looks from a perspective also there too, right? Not only in terms of what goes on in, let's say kitchen, in a kitchen behind closed doors, but also just in terms of presentation, in terms of what it looks like. You know, you have ma'arasayim issue. Look, I have an issue. It bothers me every time. And every time I say, I'm going to write a letter, I'm going to
There is no reputable kashrus organization, at least that I'm aware of today, that recommends in any capacity or even allows in a residential capacity the checking and cleaning of raspberries and blackberries. OU, Star K, CRC, everybody says don't eat them. They're infested and they become impossible to clean. And finding a batch that you know with certainty is really devoid of any infestation issue, it's just an impossibility. It's never going to happen. And therefore, you can't eat them. Can't eat them. And then you buy a cookbook and it's put out by a reputable publisher and a firm publisher. And you're like flipping through and something calls for fresh raspberries. My high. What's going on? So I don't know exactly what's going on, but like those are the kinds of considerations that in the world of kashrus you have to have about presentation, about making a certain suggestion, even when something might otherwise be mutter, right? What is it that you are saying about, and what message are you conveying? What sort of confusion are you potentially sowing when it comes to some of your policies? For a very, very, very long time, the OU would label anything that was produced on dairy equipment as OUD. I'm sure you've encountered this before, right? That there is this sort of mesora for certain things that, well, no, like if you call a company and you really ask and you find out it's actually just dairy kalin, but it's not actually dairy. So why did they never do a DE? Why didn't they ever, for the longest time, they wouldn't actually print a DE at dairy equipment, which makes a huge difference. It means that you can eat it after a fleishig meal. You can have it on Friday night or Shabbos afternoon after you finish eating. You can have it on a fleishig plate. It's just that it's dairy equipment. So why didn't they ever do so? Because there were concerns. There were concerns that, you know what, if they say that it's only dairy equipment, first of all, that's a terrible responsibility upon them to ensure that any given day and every given run and any given month or the time of the year or season or whatever, that this equipment was properly, let's say, being cleaned in between one run to the next, the milking run to the power run. That becomes very, very difficult in an industrial setting and commercial setting to really be fully aware of. Number one. And then number two, will the average consumer necessarily know what to do with that information? Oh, it's only DE, therefore I can have it together with meat. I can have it on the same plate as meat. Well, people necessarily know what to do with it. And maybe it's just, it streamlines things. If we just say, you know, it's dairy, just treat it as dairy. And if you're in the know enough to know that there's a difference between dairy and dairy kalin, dairy and dairy equipment, then call the company and they'll be able to tell you, you know, there's something to be said for that. So there are some differences that exist on an industrial level, commercial level, than when it comes to whatever is being done inside of our kitchen. But at any rate, strictly speaking, to cook milk and fleishig at the same time, if it's covered, if let's say you're usually using it for fleishig, but now you're using it for milk, if it's wrapped, that would be acceptable. Let's see chapal. Who adin ba'asher lebishel, ein levashel b'tanur sagur shtei kederos. Similarly, you can't cook two pots of food. B'sha'achas mechila tavshil b'sari va'acharas tavshil chalavi. You have two pots of food in the oven. One of which, even though it's in a container, what you may have been speaking about before is actual, like just a slab of meat or something like that. But even putting pots of food in the oven, one is fleishig and one is milchig. They're in there at the same time. Tafilo tavshil stami, even not something that's par. And bretzono la'ochol in divrei chalav, the intention is that I'm going to eat that par food with milchig food later. Velo rak b'vas achas, not only is it also to do this all at the same time, also la'asos came. It's also to even do it one after the other. One after the other, just as we said before. If one of them is covered, then it would be mutter. If you cover the milk pigs and you have the fleishig cooking even at the same time, right? Which seems absolutely scandalous, but that's basically saying is that you are cooking the milk pig food in effectively a separate oven. What is an oven? It is a box that surrounds, that envelops the food. So the pan that the milking food is inside of is surrounded, it's enveloped, and therefore that doesn't pose a kashrus concern. But it's something to, again, something to really, really be very aware of. Ubi the Evan, let's talk about the Evan. Let's say it happened. Chav Beis Ubi the Evan. Tzila bo basar below the chasosa. Let's say meat was roasted without covering it. So yesh makom lahatir lefos b'divrei ma'afas stamiyin tarva she'enu yachol l'chasosa. Could be that you could cook you could cook para food without covering it. Rak acharei me'es la'es. After me'es la'es. So what Shmir Shabbos Kilchos is talking about is not just waiting until the oven cools down, waiting 24 hours. Af im ritzono la'ochlam im divrei chalav, even if your intention is thereafter to eat it with chalav, to eat it with milchiks, ach lo divrei ma'afa chalavim, but not to eat milchiks. So this is really where it comes to a head. Meaning, what he's now saying is that if the meat was roasted, and this is again what we typically do in our kitchens, if the meat was roasted in a manner that was uncovered, so now the zeah, the steam rises up out of this meat, right, and it imbues the actual oven and the walls of the oven. So if you cook dairy food covered, that would be acceptable. If you cook dairy food uncovered, that's not acceptable, even if you've waited 24 hours. However, so here's where there's a little bit more latitude. If you've waited 24 hours and now you're cooking something parav, so maybe b'dieved, that could then be eaten with milchigs. So usually I use my oven for fleshes. But then I cooked something that the intention was that this should be parav. And it's been 24 hours since I cooked meat. And I remembered that this is actually supposed to be, this happens to us. This has definitely happened to us in advance of Yom Kippur, right? This is supposed to be for the dairy meal. It's supposed to be for the dairy meal. We meant to roast those veggies in the toaster oven. And we forgot. We did it, force of habit. Put it on a cookie sheet, goes into the oven. B'dieved, if it's been 24 hours since meat has been eaten, so now it can be eaten together with dairy. Otherwise not, meaning if it's actually milchig food, couldn't be. If it hasn't been 24 hours, then there are other postkim who might still say that that's okay as long as the oven is cooled down in between. But otherwise it would be machmir. And we would not eat that food directly with milchigs. Chaf gimel, tanur shasu letzlos bo basar. If you have an oven that ordinarily is used to roast meat, mutar letzlos bo gam basar, o kaved shelo hukshiru. You could also roast meat that is not kosher, or you could roast liver, or let's say broil, really, liver. Liver is inherently unkosher until it's broiled, because there is no way through the process, even of malicha, of salting it, to actually suck out, to draw out all of the blood that's contained within the liver. The akpir, and he's careful, he's insistent, lo vitzlos bechum gavoa, should be careful not to roast at a high heat. The akli shelasocho notev adam, and the kli that the blood is dripping into, harehu treif. That would be considered safe. That would be that you wouldn't be able to use that kli for anything. You wouldn't be allowed to use that, let's say, drip pan for anything kosher, because you have all this blood that's absorbed right inside. And he also notes that for those of you who are prepared to try this, usher litzlos kaved the mikrogal. It is usher to roast liver in a microwave. All those of you who wanted to broil liver in a microwave, that's not sufficient. You need genuine heat. I think the way that it is the most straight, the best thing to do with liver is to buy it already roasted, to buy it already broiled. You could buy it already prepared, like from a deli counter, and it's delicious. Or you could buy it, it's sold in a vacuum pack also, where it's pre-broiled. It's just a pain in the neck trying to keep a pan on you that you'll never be able to use for anything else, that it could drip into a rack, a pan, so that all the blood is really expelled. The other possibility is to do it over a grill. So do it over a grill, and then everything drips down. But then the grill itself, that all the, you know, that's absorbing the blood, that also becomes problematic. It's a pain. It's a pain to keep separate kalim, unless you have liver very, very, very often. It's really a pain to do. And Baruch Hashem for the vacuum sealed and for the deli counter. Okay, let's talk about nesios. Traveling on Erev Shabbos with the Erev Yom Tov. Let's talk about travel on Erev Shabbos and Erev Yom Tov. So the halachas here initially come across as much more harsh than we're probably familiar with. The reality is that most of the time, the way that we travel, bizman hazeh, abides by or allows for greater heterim to be employed, as we'll see at the end of this coming paragraph here. Nevertheless, it's still worthwhile being aware of what some of the guardrails are so that we can proceed with caution when it comes to travel on Erev Shabbos. And that'll be the final note here of the Shmir Shabbos Kilchasa in this section. Just care and caution when it comes to such things, when it comes to travel. Would be great to have a future shiur or set of shiur focusing on these types of practical kitchen kashrus issues. Absolutely. 100%. 100%. Yes. Mitzvah Hashem, we will do that. I actually started compiling some things and some articles and some interesting things. Basic oven usage, appliances, dishwashers is a big one. What was I going to say? Bishul Akum is such a major issue. And it seems like the sort of thing that you only have to deal with in restaurants. First of all, it's interesting to know how it is or how it is not dealt with in restaurants. Bishul Akum can occur in all of our homes if there is ever any help that you have around the house. And potentially you want to have some kitchen help from, let's say, well-meaning non-Jewish employees, all these kinds of things. Yes, it would be very, very good. So Mirtzah Hashem, we'll think about a mini series. On that note, if anybody from this group, if there are any specific questions, issues, what have you, let me know. We'll start to compile and we'll try a mini series for that. Okay. So let's talk about travel. In Holkam Be'er Shabbos O Be'er Yontov Mitchilas HaBoker. Yoser Mishalosh Parsaos. From the early hours of the day, even, you cannot set out on a trip that will take more than 3 parsaos. What does that mean? The Hainu Zman Shel Halicha Ad Shlish Hayom. We're not talking about parsaos as an actual unit of distance, which is what a parsa really is, but we mean it in terms of the conversion to the amount of time that it would traditionally take to travel a parsa, let's say by wagon or horseback or something like that. The Hainu Zman Shel Halicha Ad Shlish Hayom, or actually by foot, I believe. The Hainu Zman Shel Halicha Ad Shlish Hayom, meaning to say travel that would last for up to a third of the day. So we'd be speaking about 4 hours roughly, 4 Shaos Zmanios hours. So let's just assume it's an ideal day, 6 to 6. A third of the day, 4 hours, no 4-hour trip on Erev Shabbos. I think we often do a 4-hour trip on Erev Shabbos. I think it happens not infrequently that you set out to, I don't know, Boston for Shabbos, depending on where, and the Catskills can easily be a 4-hour, I mean, Erev Shabbos can easily be 4 hours from here. So is that mutter? Let's see. Yesh omrim. Some say, Shahu Adin Bashun Nasiya Bimakonis Akhare Hazman Hazeh Shel Shlishayom. So some say that again, it's not a matter of the actual distance, it's just the time. It's the timing. So however much distance you can travel, whatever it is, you can't set out on a trip on Erev Shabbos if that trip is going to take you more than or up to a third of the day, 4 hours. The reason for this is, in order to ensure that the traveler arrives at his destination, but Od Hayom Gadol, while it's still very, very much Erev Shabbos, so that you're not right on the line, so that you're not approaching Shabbos itself, the Yuchlu Lahachin Tzorchei Seudos Shabbos O Yom Tov Bishvila. The concern is not so much that, oh, if you miscalculate, you're not going to get there in time for Shabbos. That's something else we'll talk about that. But the reason for this institution is you need to get, why only 4 hours? If I leave at 9 o'clock in the morning, really, is there such great concern? If I arrive at 1 in the afternoon, is that such a problem? If I leave at 6 in the morning, is that so terrible? So we want to ensure that not only are you getting there before Shabbos, but that you're getting there with enough time to then prepare Shabbos, to make sure that you'll have a proper Shabbos, that you don't just throw together a haphazard sort of Shabbos at the last minute, half-baked, maybe even literally, because you arrived at your destination late. So b'medvar memurim, if that's the case, and when does all the supply, kasher lo kidia albo, that's when you didn't tell anybody you were coming. And this was oftentimes the case, right? We think of, like, why would you ever not let people know that you're coming for Shabbos? because when communication moves very, very slowly, you need to write a letter in advance to let them know that you're going to be there. And maybe something happened in the intervening time between the letter being sent and arriving, and then you're making actual travel plans. And maybe you were delayed and travel was much more difficult. And maybe this was the last leg of a multi-day journey, even though it's only going to take a few hours today. All those reasons. So you're supposed to already come on Wednesday. You're supposed to come the following week or whatever it was, and you weren't able to let people know. So if they don't know that you're coming, that's when all this applies. So they didn't even know to prepare for you. Now you're going to show up. They're only going to be a few more hours to Shabbos. There's no concern about the Lulacha. You're there plenty of time before Shabbos, but they didn't know to prepare for you. They didn't know you were coming. However, if you inform them that you'd be coming with plenty of time for them to prepare for you, then you could travel a long distance. If the whole concern, really, the whole concern is that I'm going to get there and there won't be any food prepared and I'm not going to be able to prepare my food properly and they're not going to prepare for me. But if they already knew that I was coming, they were preparing for me, they knew that I was going to be there, they made food for me, so then there's no problem. Similarly, and this likely characterizes the average place that we would end up going to. Certainly the average Chabad in the middle of wherever it is, as we're on our cross-country trip, and we were supposed to have made it to South Bend for Shabbos. And we didn't quite make it. And instead we find ourselves in, I don't know, Toledo, right? Something like that, right? So we end up finding ourselves in some place where there isn't, let's say, a really vibrant from community. And I have to impose upon, let's say, one of the few from people. Generally speaking, today again, certainly something like Chabad and shuls and whatever. But I think the average family, if there ended up being, you know, another few people who came for Shabbos, oh, don't worry, we're working at Baruch Hashem. We live in a time of revach. We live in a time of surplus and of plenty. And for the most part, it's not a problem. So when you end up getting the call from Chaverim that, oy vey, our car broke down, we're going to Baltimore, and can we come for Shabbos? It's usually no problem whatsoever to accommodate extra guests. So if you're going to a place where you know that they're going to have food, so do I even need to tell them? I know there's going to be food. I know they're going to have food, even if I surprise them. Can I drop a surprise visit, right? What fun. When I came, I mean, this wasn't on Erev Shabbos, but my first year in Eretz Yisrael, I told my parents that I was planning on staying in yeshiva for Pesach, and that was my plan. But as yeshiva started clearing out, got more and more depressing, I said, you know what? And my parents kept, it'd be so nice if you came with the idea. So I decided to surprise them. It was great. It was great. You know, Baruch Hashem, everybody survived the initial shock. But it's the sort of thing where like, is that mutter? Is that mutter? Can you do that on an Erev Shabbos? Can you surprise somebody? Guess what? I'm here for Shabbos. You have no idea what's going on. Is that okay? Is that mutter? Yeah. People usually have plenty of food for Shabbos. And there's more than enough food to go around. And for an extra guest or an extra couple of guests, it's usually no problem. And therefore, many of the concerns surrounding travel on Erev Shabbos really are lifted. They simply don't apply to Zman Hazeh. There's no need to prepare anything, especially for the guest. So therefore, we don't need to be careful, and we don't need to be concerned with the length of the travel. Nevertheless, you still have to schedule your trip wisely and properly. And plan and account for things, expect the unexpected. Expect that there's going to be get more traffic than here. Going to the mountains on Erev Shabbos, it could be 4 hours from here. Assume it could be 6 hours, because you never know. And you never know when your tire blows out. You never know when this happens and that happens. And then you end up being in a position where I'm not worried about food, because wherever it is that I write, I'm going to the mountains, right? I don't need to be worried about food, because wherever it is, whatever bungalow colony I end up in, they're going to have plenty of food for me, and that won't be a problem. The real problem is I don't want to end up there. I want to get to my destination. And what's the problem with being so bent on getting to your destination? The problem is that as Shabbos gets closer and closer, so you can that way get to the place that you're planning on spending Shabbos while it's still day. right? Just like we spoke about, or to some degree along the same lines, when we get so preoccupied, I gotta have this for Shabbos, I gotta have that for Shabbos, we gotta stuff it all, gotta make. And sometimes, you know, haste makes waste, and it can lead to potential conscious issues, and we could cut corners in our great interest and zeal to prepare whatever that extra dish was that I told myself I was going to make this week, and I saw it, I didn't want to have it, and you know, we got to do it, and I promised the kids that I'd make it, and we can have it now, and then, but there's nothing in the oven. Okay, so it's probably okay. I'll just put it on the other side of the oven. We made pizza last night, and now it's fine. It's cooled down. It's okay. It's not a problem. So sometimes we can cut corners also when it's, oh no, I got to get there for Shabbos. What if you don't go to Shabbos? What would happen? Breathe 10 seconds. What would happen if you didn't get in the car right now and you didn't try to get there for Shabbos? What would be so terrible? You'd end up having Shabbos at home. You'd maybe have to impose upon some friends and go there for Shabbos, or just blow off the trip and, you know, start cooking instead of the travel time. Sometimes we just need to stop, pause, pull back, reassess. And again, if we're going to be traveling on Erev Shabbos, to do so in a way that will build in enough time so that we can rest assured that we'll get to where we need to go. Bear in mind that today it's not only potentially car travel, it's also air travel. And air travel on Erev Shabbos is much more complicated because, you know, when you're driving, you can usually tell, oh, you know what, I'm not really going to make it. Let me pull off and I'll drive an extra half hour. And then I'll end up where I'll end up in some prim community, right? If I'm in, you know, most civilized areas of the United States. But if I'm flying and I'm pushing it, I could end up stuck in an airport. I could end up with the inability to like get a car, get an Uber. There's just so much more that needs to happen in order to move from point A to point B. We can travel hundreds and thousands of miles in a day, but nevertheless, there are the realities of in and out of the airport and through security and getting a car and getting to where we want to be. So we got to be very, very cautious. And the potential concern of Kol Shabbos is very, very much a real one when it comes to travel on Erev Shabbos that potentially can even move into Shabbos itself. What about eating a large meal or eating any meal on Erev Shabbos? Not only what we're preparing to eat, but also what we perhaps refrain from eating and how we eat on Erev Shabbos is also part of preparing for Shabbos, because going in with an appetite is also an important component of Kavod Shabbos. What does that look like? So Chaf Hei. Part of preparing properly for Shabbos, part of Kavod Shabbos, is that you enter into Shabbos in a state of having an appetite, of wanting to eat. Shabbos, a Yom Tov, for a Gam Lahalon, Perak Mem Zayin, Sif Kafal. This is divided into different areas and different issues. Chavva. At no point on Erev Shabbos or on Erev Yom Tov should we be eating a Sa'uda that is greater, larger, better, grander than the sort of Sa'uda that we typically eat on a regular day. If on a regular day I got a sandwich and I got a salad and then I have kind of like a nice dinner. So you want to have a couple of slices of pizza on an Erev Shabbos, by all means. But to do something that's significantly more extensive, that really blows the top off of what we usually have during the week, that's not appropriate to be done on Erev Shabbos. Kagon Seudas Mireyan, like a nice, like a get-together. Family get-together, we'll do a big brunch, a big Seuda on Erev Shabbos. Not appropriate. Vafidu Seudas Mitzvah, She'in Zmana Davka Be'yom Se, even if it's Seudas Mitzvah. Seudas Mitzvah, the reason why it's a lavish is because it's a Seudas Mitzvah. That's what this Mitzvah didn't have to be today. Didn't have to be today. You made a siyum. Well, you made a siyum 2 days ago. Why'd you do it on Erev Shabbos? It was convenient. I was off on Friday, so we decided to make it today. You end up with a larger seuda than you usually keep to during the week. That's not appropriate. It's not like, well, we just finished today, so I have to do it today. But rather, it just worked out to do it today. That's not right. Gam ki asura, that is prohibited. Chav zayin. Mutzal arok be'erev Shabbos o be'erev Yom Tov seudas mitzvah. Shezmano davka be'yom zeh. However, if this is when, this is the eighth day, this is when the bris has got to be, or this is when the limud naturally finished. We always make a siyum for daf yomi on the day that we finished, and I finished on a Friday, so that would be okay. Pidyon Haben, etc. But it is a mitzvah to make that su'uda as early as possible, certainly before chatzos, so that again, you're not running into a situation where you're still eating heavily in the second half of the day. Only b'di'evad is it mutter to make this during the second half of the day, after chatzos, after midday. And in that case, if you at least set the meal prior to the last quarter of the day, right, prior to the last 3 hours of the day, meaning Tesha Shos, before 9 hours of the day have completely lapsed, Shel Hayom, then Archena Karagil, it could be set regularly, right? So, B'dieved, we were really supposed to have the Pidyon Haben earlier in the day. The Siyum was supposed to be early in the day. This was the day for it. We were supposed to do it early in the day. It didn't work out. We wanted to do it before Chatzos. It didn't happen. I don't know. Doctor had to look at the baby again. Whatever it is. So now we're doing it after Chatzos. We're doing it after midday. If it's still before the end of the 9 hours, if it's still before that last quarter of the day, then you could still be the Yevon and make a regular Seuda. However, if that last quarter of the day has already begun, then just have a little bit of bread. Just have a little something. A little something just to say, Yotze Zayin, I made my Seudas Mitzvah. This way, it doesn't run afoul of ruining your appetite, spoiling your appetite for the Seudos Shabbos. So this would apply to, let's say, an Erev Yom Tov that falls on Shabbos. It's an Erev Yom Tov that falls on Shabbos, meaning to say that Yontif starts on Motzei Shabbos, it's Saturday night after Shabbos is over. You didn't eat Chal Shudas. Oh, I wanted to eat Chal Shudas earlier. You didn't eat Chal Shudas earlier. So now what? Now I have a Chiyuv to eat a Seudas Mitzvah, Shal Shudas, and it's already after Chatzos. So if it's yet before the last quarter of the day, you can still be the Yevet, have a regular Seudah. But if it's after 9 hours, then you just have a little something, just have a little bit of bread, Kazayas of bread, just to be able to say that it is a Seudas Mitzvah. L'gavi Yom Tov, Shechal Yos Be'erev Shabbos, so let's say Yom Tov falls on Erev Shabbos, Los Biklo Echol Seudah Seyom Shal Yom Tov, L'nei Chatzos Seyom. Somehow or another, you didn't even get to your Seudah, your regular Seudah. Sukkos Torah falls out on Erev Shabbos, right? And by the time you get home after everything, oh, I meant to eat in shul and to grab some matzah and to sit down and actually have a Seudah, and I didn't. Now I still have to have a Seudah. As long as it's before that last quarter of the day, you can still have a regular Seudah. Let's say the eighth day, and the Bris Mila falls out on Erev Shabbos, Erev Yom Tov. Or even if the bris was pushed off, so it's not the eighth day, but now this is the first opportunity to have it. The baby's healthy now. Or Lagabi Pidyon Haben, Kishayom HaShloshim De'echad, who Erev Shabbos, oh, Erev Yom Tov. Oh, I feel how you follow with those in Mikodem, and Mishum Ma, Nidkala Erev Shabbos Yom Tov. Whether the Pidyon Haben is on time and it falls out on Erev Shabbos Erev Yom Tov, or it's not on time, but it got delayed for some reason, for some purpose, but now this is the first opportunity you have to make it, you would still do it on an Erev Shabbos. Or Lagabi Purim. Shachalios b'yom shishi. It happened this past year. Lagabe bar mitzvah bo b'yom. Or let's say have a bar mitzvah there that very day. Not that we decided to celebrate on Erev Shabbos, but it's actually today. The bo b'yom, the actual day of the bar mitzvah is today. So that would then be appropriate to have an actual seudah. Okay, let's just do a couple more here, and we'll finish up with this section. So mitzvah lihimana be'erev Shabbos with Erev Yom Tov. So ideally, we should refrain also, even from a seudah that we typically would have during the rest of the week, a regular seudah, normal seudah, when? That last quarter of the day, last 3 hours of the day, after 9 hours, even the couple slices of pizza, we try to refrain from that, ideally. Especially when it's the winter months, and therefore the days are short. Mitzvah limana gam lefneza, even beforehand, meaning this is that it is reasonable to impose even a greater stringency when it comes to a short day. Technically speaking, if you really look at the calculation, I'm still okay. I can have my pizza, but if I have these two slices of pizza, I'm going to be eating it like a few hours from now. And I'm going to be eating it a few hours, a couple hours from now. So then it's going to spoil my appetite. Cheers, man. I think we tend to have stronger appetites now. It's sort of counterintuitive. You would think that the best fed generation in human history would always be full. We would like never have an interest in eating. Just the opposite. It seems that the more we eat, the more we want to eat. I don't know. It's not all that difficult to stimulate an appetite when necessary. Chavtes, achila muletes, eating a small amount. The hainu bli kviyasuda, meaning eating without a kviyasuda, not sitting down to a meal, not washing, not eating halotzi. That you can even have a little snack right before pregame. Have a little pregame right before Shabbos. That's still mother. But as soon as Shabbos actually comes, either you will makabel Shabbos or Shabbos falls, Shabbos descends. Oh, shatzibur kiblu as a Shabbos. The tzibur lets say accepted Shabbos. Also, lechol bishkos kol davar. You can't eat or drink anything. You have to be very careful. No noshing, no grabbing something, not until Kiddush, and you actually start your Se'uda. This becomes even more strict on Erev Pesach. Erev Pesach, Minei Rabbi Yisrael, Achronah Shel Hayom, Ve'elach Asur Lechol Gam Se'udah Regilim Ba B'Chol Yimos HaShavua. It is Asur, not only that it's a good idea, not only that it's a mitzvah to avoid, but it becomes Asur on Erev Pesach. It becomes Asur on Erev Pesach to eat a Se'uda, even a regular Se'uda, after the ninth hour. Even if you're not eating either chametz or matzah, eating chametz or matzah on Pesach comes with its own, that's its own ball of wax. Can't eat matzah on Erev Pesach. It's usher to eat matzah before the Seder night, before the actual Seder, before the matzah mitzvah at the Seder night. You can't eat matzah on Erev Pesach. We have a minhag of not eating matzah already from either Rosh Chodesh or even 30 days before. And you can't eat chametz on Erev Pesach either after sixth hour, even the fifth hour. So even aside from that, you're eating matzah ashira, you're eating egg matzah. So strictly speaking, that is something that's mutter to be eaten on Erev Pesach, but to actually sit down to a se'uda after 9 hours, that is totally usher to do on Erev Pesach. If you have a little something, fruits, vegetables, a ma'at basar v'dagan, a little piece of fish, a little piece of meat, tied you over until the Seder. Lo yimalei kreis amehem, just be careful not to fill your belly. The din Erev Sukkos, Kedin Erev Pesach. In general, we find that there is an association between Sukkos and Pesach. The same way that we eat a kezias of matzah on Pesach, we also must eat a kezias in the Sukkah on the first night of Sukkos. The rest of Sukkos, if you want to eat, then you got to eat in the Sukkah. But you don't have to, strictly speaking, eat in the Sukkah on the rest of Sukkos. You don't have to eat. You don't have to eat any real meal. You could just circumvent it and avoid it the whole way through. But Mida Oraisa, even on a Torah level, on the night of Sukkot, there's a mitzvah to eat in the Sukkah. Similarly, the way that we prepare for eating that kezias is through teyavon, through having an appetite for it, and hence the prohibition to not eat on Erev Sukkot, even a regular Se'uda, after 9 hours into the day. And you can make these calculations. Usually, I think, with a tickle of it, Maizmanim, I think, tells you what 9 hours are. We're the Halon Parak Nunvav. If you base the Gabi Arpesh Kalyas B'Shabbos, Kedos Malasos B'Suda Shlishes. This is where you run into a problem. How do I, on the one hand, eat Shalosh Shudis on Erev Pesach? If let's say Shabbos is Erev Pesach, how do I eat Shalosh Shudis if it's usher for me to eat after 9 hours? You want to make sure that you eat your first meal early enough so you can then have Shalosh Shudis. What we did, I think it was this past year, right? We davened early. So that you could, that's another consideration. That was because of matzah and chametz and all of that, right? That's another issue. Getting rid of, right? Still having challah potentially, and then getting rid of it so you can actually have a seuda. What else are you supposed to eat? Other considerations there. That's what we did this past Pesach. Lamed aleph, seudas havra'a. What about a seudas havra'a? Seudas havra'a is the first meal that avelim have when they come back from the Beis HaKvaros. When my father's Levaya was on Erev Rosh Hashanah. So this happened. We came back and we had a Seuda Sevra. It was still pretty early in the day. So you have that first Seuda shows them the Krove Haniftar Achare HaKvura that the Avelim that the mourners have after the burial. Since strictly speaking, it's not really a Chova. It's not a strict obligation to eat that Seuda. Tov lo la'asosa be'erv Shabbos ve'erv Yom Tov samach l'chnisas ha'Shabbos o'achat. Try to avoid doing that near, close to Shabbos or the start of the Yantif. Because we're trying to be mechabi the day by coming in with an appetite for the seudos. Generally, under most circumstances, levayas usually are earlier in the morning, and therefore the seuda is earlier in the day. It doesn't always work out that way, depending on when the actual misa was, but it's something that we should know. but maybe to be faintly aware of this when it does occur, lo aleinu. But this idea that it's a minhag to eat that seudas havrah, but it's not as strict an obligation as some of these other seudos mitzvah that we were referring to. And therefore, if it's a question of, well, it's really getting close to Shabbos, it's already after 9 hours, really best to just refrain, says Shmir Shabbos Kolkosav, to just refrain from eating the seudas havrah if it comes up even adjacent to Shabbos or adjacent to Yom Tov. Okay, we'll begin next with Asiyas Malacha Be'erev Shabbos. What are the kinds of activities, behaviors, malachos that we refrain from doing already on Erev Shabbos? Mitzvah Shem, we will discuss that next time. Okay, thanks again for jumping on, everybody. Good to be back. Good to be back in the routine. And God willing, looking forward to next week as well. Have a wonderful night.
Good night. Thank you.
Thank you. Good night. Good night.